The UN says that humanity stands on the brink of catastrophic man-made climate change. But is it true?
Not a chance. But we do stand on the brink of catastrophic government policies that threaten to ruin the nation our forefathers built and defended against tyranny.
So what drives the climate scare, Jay?
Besides simple ignorance, the scare is driven by corporate greed and the desire of government to control all aspects of our lives, Tom.
Is this part of something more sinister?
Indeed it is. Whether it's climate change or a pandemic or socialism, it really means sacrificing your rights and accepting the tyranny of the fourth branch of government, the bureaucracy. It must be stopped.
This is The Other Side of the Story with Dr. Jay Lair and Tom Harris of the International Climate Science Coalition.
Our guest this week is Dr. Howard Hayden, Professor of Physics Emeritus of the University of Connecticut. Dr. Hayden earned bachelor, master's, and PhD degrees in physics from University of Denver. Following this, Howard went to the University of Connecticut, where he spent 32 years teaching and doing research. His research background is in accelerator-based atomic and molecular collisions, which he tells me is not the same kind of high-energy accelerators used in particle research. Dr. Hayden is editor of The Energy Advocate, a monthly newsletter promoting energy and technology, which has been running for 26 years. He's the author of, among other publications, The Solar Fraud, Why Solar Energy Won't Run the World, which I have here right on my shelf, actually, a primer on CO2 and climate, a primer on renewable energy, and my favorite, Bass Ackwards, How Climate Alarmists Confuse Cause with Effect. We will include links to all of these books under the podcast when it goes on the internet on Monday. So welcome to the show, Professor Hayden.
Oh, glad to be here.
Well, Howard, this is really very exciting for me, and I will let the audience know you have been one of my best mentors, even though we're close in age. You are well ahead of me in your physics knowledge, although all of my work skirted the topic. You have been kind enough for, God, it seems like 20 years to answer my emails that generally on the subject line would just say help, and I would pose a question that confused me, and you always came to my rescue, which was exciting. But I suppose my recognition that wind and solar made no sense as a significant source of energy for the electric grids across our country when I read and reviewed your first book, The Solar Fraud, which not only dealt with solar energy, it also dealt with wind energy. And it was the first time that I fully understood, well, ultimately the stupidity that so many people think we can have our standard of living on wind and solar energy, which might have worked back around 1850 in a whole different level of society than now. But I'd be interested historically to know how you came about writing that book, and let's say when the realization came to you of how the country was beginning to really go in a wrong direction.
I was interested in solar energy kind of vaguely for a long time, but I didn't have any expertise in it. Once upon a time, I was called upon to evaluate kind of a solar heat system for a local builder in Connecticut. And I actually had to do some work to find out about how much sunlight we got and so forth. And then it just expanded from there. What I found out was that people were talking about various kinds of energy and using a profusion of bizarre units, and they could not talk to one another. So in way back in 1981 or so, I wrote a paper trying to get everybody to speak in the same language, which happens to be the International system of units. But anyway, then I started writing about solar energy. I had another talk paper about solar energy that same year. And what I realized is that all forms of solar energy depend on how much sunlight you get per unit land area. Well, for example, let's put it this way, that all solar-based energy can be, let's say, made equal, made equivalent, made comparable. Comparable is a better word. Made comparable by a reference to how much energy they produce per unit land area. For example, when you talk about wind turbines, well, you think of a big old thing sticking up there, blowing around in the wind. You can't have wind turbines lined up one behind the other, because the job of a wind turbine is to extract energy from the wind, and the wind is slower behind the first one. And it slows down, and then at the second windmill would be in the path of the slow wind. And so long and short of it is you have to spread them out very, very widely. And so you can talk about how much you get per unit land area that way. When you talk about sunlight, you got to talk about how much sunlight you intercept. When you talk about hydro, now hydro works by sunlight evaporating water, carrying it up to clouds. They fall on the mountains and so forth, and then descend. And what you really care about is how much power you can get per unit land area that's collecting all that water and so forth. So everything in solar has got to be expressed in units of how much you get out of how much land area. And that was, in a way, kind of a revelation. It's simple-minded. I mean, it should be obvious to anybody who thinks about it, but it certainly hadn't to me at that time.
The city of Ottawa wants to put up 710 industrial scale wind turbines, typically over 100 meters in height, within our city limits. Now, how many wind turbines per area would you typically get for those huge machines?
The interesting thing about the wind turbines is that if you double the diameter of a wind turbine, you quadruple the amount of power. Well, that sounds pretty good. On the other hand, you have to put them twice as far apart in both directions, which means you're occupying four times as much land area. So you get four times the amount of power in four times the land area. So what's really concerned is how much power do you get per acre, per hectare, and so forth. And it turns out that in excellent sites, you get about 5 kilowatts per acre. That's for the American audience. 12.5 kilowatts per hectare. That's for the Canadian audience. The number is pretty much independent of the number of wind turbines, but because they're usually just spaced 10 diameters apart or so.
Mm-hmm. I see, 10 diameters apart. That's typical then for the really big ones.
Howard, the average person who has no science base or hasn't studied a lot of this stuff, they actually think the sun and wind are free. And of course, they're anything but. When one tries to harness them, they cost a tremendous amount of money. What is the simplest response one can give to a non-scientist friend to dissuade them of this falsehood that the wind and the sun are free?
I think the first thing to do is to concede the fact that the sunlight itself is free. The wind itself is free. It's just that it costs a lot to collect those kinds of energy. The other thing to do is to point out that both wind and solar, which have grown a lot in recent years, owe their existence primarily to subsidies. Well, there was an article recently by an economist who said that, well, they're big enough now that they don't need the subsidies. Just try to take them away and just see what happens. They can't run without subsidies.
That's really my next question, Howard. In your opinion, how have the wind power and solar power lobbies taken such a strong grip on our Congress to keep the public subsidizing wind and solar, I think, to the tune of at least 50% of their costs? You might have a better number than that.
I occasionally look at those things, but if I knew anything about money, I would probably not have gone to a university for a career. Well, I used to get paid weekly once a month.
Okay. So why are these lobbies so powerful, you know, when we know, you know, it's not a good source of energy?
Well, a part of it is selling disaster. Newspapers thrive on selling horror stories. That's just the way they live. And so does the evening news. And so do politicians. I mean, they all thrive on making up some kind of hobgoblins, and they've got to solve them, and they all have to do it in a big hurry. So we better get on the case and do it right now. And the hobgoblin that they use right now is, of course, climate change. Once upon a time, it was, the heating up the earth because you're using nuclear reactors. And then they talk about, it used to be the pollution caused by coal and so forth. They're made up catastrophes. Well, actually, if you go back a long time, coal was really, really dirty. In fact, my dad had a coal yard when I was young, and he basically put himself out of business by switching everybody over to natural gas. And I think I probably delivered the last load of coal from the company when I was 14.
It's interesting that you said that, because there was a time when coal was a very dirty form of energy. But clean coal has changed that dramatically. And I'm working on an article. We belong to a local electric consolidated program, and they use coal, and they have built the most sophisticated coal generation plant that literally gives off no toxic emissions whatsoever. And I was able to get a hold of the diagrams of how they do that. And I'm very excited about writing an article and using the diagram and publishing it and showing people what clean coal is and how really very, very, very clean it is.
There's a local power station called the Comanche Power Station. And it had, my numbers may not be right, something like a two different 350 megawatt generators in it. And I'm going to say 15 years ago, they put in Comanche Unit 3 that had 750 megawatts. And they were not allowed to put it in unless they updated the pollution controls on the other two units, which they did, in fact, do. I'm within, there's kind of a nice overlook looking onto Lake Pueblo nearby, and I go over there and I can very clearly see the stacks, and I have never seen anything coming out of those stacks except just plain old steam. They've done a marvelous job.
Yeah, it really is exciting. You know, Tom and I have discussed often on this show that wind and solar power do nothing to help the U.S. energy output except drive up the cost, because every kilowatt hour of wind and solar on a grid must mean more conventional carbon-based power must be built to back it up, when, as always, it becomes undependable when the sun is not shining and the wind is not blowing. Would you add your thoughts to this dilemma that no matter how much wind and solar is attached to any electric utility or any electric grid, it makes no additional available power because you've got to match it with more dependable power? Would you agree with that statement or add to it?
Yeah, you always have to back it up. And where I live, there would be more, say, minute-by-minute backup required for wind than for solar because the sunlight can be pretty steady all day. But nonetheless, you still have to have that full power available to run you when you have cloudy days or when you have zero wind or very slow wind, because the power output from a wind turbine varies dramatically with the wind speed. And for example, you get eight times as much power at 20 mile an hour wind as you get at 10. And so the fluctuations in the wind just have to be compensated. And what that means is that the gas powered turbines, you know, they're producing power and speeding up and slowing down and speeding up and slowing down, just like you do in heavy traffic, and it cuts down their efficiency. Even at that, even suppose things ran pretty steadily and you didn't have to do that, think of it this way, that you've got some equipment that you paid for and built and so forth on the basis that you expect it to generate so many megawatt hours per year. And now you have to turn it down and not use it some of the time so that you're getting fewer megawatt hours per year. So the long and short of it is you have to jack up your megawatt hour price to pay for your installation. And of course, your labor and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that is something that I hope our listeners understand and share. But I've got a dilly of a question that I'm guessing most of our listeners are not really knowledgeable about. And that is that wind and sun enthusiasts always think technology will improve these sources of power. Can you tell us why we have essentially reached the end of any significant potential improvements in the basic technology that brings us the ability to harvest wind and solar?
Well, let me add to their case in a kind of a humorous way. Yes, technology has really improved things so much that at places like the University of Colorado in Boulder and Colorado State University in Fort Collins, they've improved things so much that the sun shines 24 hours a day.
Yeah, good one.
You know, it's no amount of technology can make the sun shine any brighter. No amount of technology can change the speed of the wind. It just doesn't happen. You can improve your apparatus. But let's say you're making a decision about solar cells. Suppose you have some solar cells that are 18% efficient. And you find out that somebody has found a way to manufacture some that are 23% efficient. Well, there's a big improvement right there. Now the question is, how much do you spend? Or let's put it this way. Suppose you need to generate, say, 500 kilowatts or something, or, you know, like 20 megawatts. Let's say you want to build a 20 megawatt solar power plant. Is it cheaper to buy the 18% or to buy more land and buy more land, or is it cheaper to buy the 23% and buy less land? The efficiency for a solar cell is simply amounts to a trade-off between cost of the device and cost of land. And it's a fairly simple kind of a, but I mean, engineers will have to do this kind of calculation all the time, but it isn't as if there's anything particularly complicated about it.
Mm-hmm. And isn't wind a pretty mature technology right now?
Well, yeah, you know that they're using the same design for their blades that was invented by somebody called the Wright brothers.
Yeah, exactly.
quite seriously. Let's say you have a propeller in an airplane, and your job is to send the propeller's job is to send air to the rear to propel you forward. It's best if the wind going out of your propeller is going essentially at a constant speed for all parts off all parts of the propeller. So you'll notice if you just go look at any propeller anywhere, you'll find out that way out at the edge, it's making a very mild cut into the air, and it toward the center, you take a more aggressive cut into the air to force all that air back at the same speed. And that was designed by the Wright brothers, and it's been used on airplanes ever since, and it's used in the wind turbines as well.
Mm-hmm. But the wind turbines, of course, are getting variable wind speed.
Yes, yeah. They're getting variable wind speed, but the thing is that wind turbine blades themselves can rotate on their own axes so that when the wind slows down, you make a more aggressive cut so that it turns the turbine a little bit faster. And there is a limit called the Bates limit that amounts to the fact that you cannot extract more than 59% of the energy from the wind. Most wind turbines get up to somewhere around 40-45%, but usually at some given wind speed. The reason for that is that the power that's available in the wind goes up with the third power, the cube of the wind speed. And so in principle, that just gets, say, wind speed gets up to 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 meters per second. Well, gee, you get a whole lot of power there. Oh, but you can't, because now you're getting more power than the generator can handle. So they go to maximum power, and then they just trim the blades. And once you get to 25 meters a second, they just shut off in order to keep the unit from blowing apart.
25, that's not very fast. So in other words, at high wind speed, we're getting nothing out of these wind turbines.
Yeah, we're talking 25 meters a second, which is like 75 feet per second, which is a slow. What do you call that kind of, not a slider, but in baseball, what do they call that when a guy throws a slow ball?
Yeah, a changeup is change-up, what it's called, yeah. And a changeup with a little curve to it is called a slider. But it's interesting that you raise the wind speed in meters or 75 feet per second. As a skydiver, I'm always concerned with the wind, because just as a turbine has to shut off when the wind's too strong, I will not jump out of an airplane when the wind is too strong. And my limits are 20 miles per hour, and we always use miles per hour rather than feet per second. Is where you've kind of at the decision-making point, you want to jump or not. At 25 miles an hour, you damn well better not jump, because as you come in for a landing, you may get smashed to the ground, which has happened to me among 1,500 skydives once in a while, but you learn your lesson. But that is interesting, and I'm sure very few people realize, they think the windier it is, oh, that's even better for wind power. And of course, when it's too windy, you get nothing. I've got a question that I guarantee you one of our listeners wants to hear. I'm not sure we have time enough in this segment or not, but it's that here in Central Ohio, I see solar panels on the roofs all over the area where I live. And sometimes companies rent them. They get 20-year contracts and, of course, huge subsidies. But I still expect long-term the homeowners will not end up happy. And I want to know your thoughts on this, and perhaps we can tackle this when we come back for our next segment.
Well, I'll give it some thought there. There are a lot of solar panels around here. They're very aggressive about pushing them. I will tell you that. And they don't get aggressive about pushing anything unless there's a buck to be made.
All right. Let's take a break now, and we'll tackle that when we get back.
Sounds fine.
Get real, let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, this is McCullough Report. Are you tired of your tired vitamins? Consider Healthy Cell. These are pill-free vitamins that are in convenient gel packs. I like the Focus and Recall supplement. I use this a lot. You know, your brain uses a lot of energy, and it depends on a variety of micronutrients and vitamins. Boost your short-term focus and long-term brain power with Healthy Cell's Focus and Recall vitamins. So go to HealthyCell.com, use the code OUTLOUD, all capital letters, OUTLOUD, for a 20% off your first order of any HealthyCell product. Let's get real, let's get loud, on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
In 2008, the amount of concentrated time people could spend on a task without becoming distracted was 12 seconds. 5 years later, it was only 8 seconds, 1 second less than a goldfish. If you find yourself always distracted or having trouble recalling information, you're likely to fall behind in the demanding, fast-paced 21st century. In other words, brain performance is more critical now than ever. Boost your brain power with Healthy Cells Focus Plus Recall. Science-backed nootropics to sharpen focus, concentrate longer, enhance recall, improve mental speed, learn rapidly, and be more alert. It's a pill-free brain supplement made with maximum absorption technology, designed to feed our brains at the cellular level. Take it for a test drive. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Focus Plus Recall. That's HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Well, there was a time when Americans could rely on the Fourth Estate. Well, in these challenging times, the media is both reckless and complicit. AmericaOutLoud.com. Top analysis from leading experts, articles, podcast, video, and 24/7 talk radio. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Howard, I'm seeing solar panels on the roofs of homes all over Central Ohio where I live. Most of them seem to get 20-year contracts from the manufacturers or suppliers, and they're huge subsidies. I still have a feeling that the average homeowner at the end of their contract, long-term, are not going to be particularly happy with having put the solar panels on their houses. What is your opinion?
Well, I would say I see a lot of those around here now too. And every time I pick up the phone, somebody's trying to sell me some solar panels. And I figure that when somebody's working that hard to sell something, there's big bucks in it for them. And so it's probably that they're going to get some massive subsidies. And they actually, the power company gets a certain amount of subsidy too by fostering this silly thing of having the solar panels. So they push it. But I must tell you about a new kind of billing that's going in. When you pay your electric bill, you pay for usually so many kilowatt hours that you've used during the month. And that cost covers many things, including the labor, including the fuel that's used to produce the electricity. It includes the maintenance of the wires, maintenance of the equipment, and so forth. So what some places have done is to have people put in these solar collectors, and then what they do is they use electricity from the solar collectors during the day, but there's often quite a bit of excess, so they sell it to the power company at retail rates. That's what net metering is all about. You buy it and sell it at the same rate, which means you're not paying for all of the incidental costs of generating and delivering all the electricity. So I was talking to a utility executive some months ago over in the San Luis Valley, and he told me that they're changing the billing because of this, so that there are two aspects to the bill. One of them is that there is a, let's call it a maintenance fee or a service fee or something like that, that includes all those things like their labor costs and their equipment costs, the mortgage that they have, all the financial expenses and all that kind of stuff. And then they have a differential cost of a few cents per kilowatt hour that they have to pay on wholesale rates for generating electricity. And this is paying for coal or natural gas or something like that. So that when they do that, the net metering then only applies at the wholesale rate rather than the retail rate. And I think that this is going to hit those people much sooner than they think.
I totally agree with you. And I think the maintenance on, I've seen a lot of maintenance problems on the rooftop solar cells. So I'm very comfortable telling people when they get the phone calls that you get trying to sell them a bill of goods for solar panels on their roofs to say no, thank you, because in the long run, they're not going to be happy. I want to ask about, I want to tell you really our audience about your awesome newsletter, the Energy Advocate, that I've been getting and learning from for years. But in it, you rarely get into the politics of wind and solar, which I do a lot. It's my view that the government wants wind and solar so badly because they know it cannot accommodate the American lifestyle, which would put them in a position to have to ration energy. Have you given that any thought, or do you agree, or you think I'm far out on that idea?
Well, let me tell you about politics. When I was in high school, a friend and I found out that we could get anybody elected that we wanted to simply by supporting their opponent.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So I do not pretend to have any expertise in politics. And in fact, I'm really kind of a naive person. In any case, when you talk about motives and that kind of thing, I like to give the advice that you should always assume ignorance before malice.
You know, that's so funny. I've got to add a personal highlight here. I was just, I have two daughters that live in California, and I think it's difficult to live in California long without becoming a very strong liberal. And my daughters are both aware that I was an advisor to President Trump about climate change and played a significant role in pulling out of the Paris Accord. And I spent 4 days with them last week, and claiming ignorance was basically the program. And I found that after about half a day with them, they absolutely gave up trying to get me to agree or disagree on anything, because I was clearly so dumb. And after that, we just had a wonderful visit together. So it really was fun. But I am convinced, and you're staying out of it, that the government knows full well wind and solar are absurd, can never support our economy. But the more of it they can force on us, the more energy will have to be rationed, and they will be in charge of rationing. But that's neither here nor there, but we'll see what happens in the coming years.
Yeah. I had a couple of quick environmental questions.
Excuse me, Tom. I think in some cases you're overestimating their intelligence.
I had a couple of environmental questions. Does the local pollution and greenhouse gas, you know, CO2, actually reduce when you figure that the backup has to ramp up and down regularly? I mean, it strikes me that if you drive a car at 20 and then 2 and then 60 and then 4, if you're constantly varying the backup, does the pollution in a jurisdiction actually reduce when you have the backup with wind and solar power?
Well, I would say that it's not correct to call CO2 pollution.
No, right.
but let's just talk about CO2 because people like to. I would say that probably you do reduce the production of CO2 because you are producing a fair amount of energy under those circumstances. But you know, when those big wind turbines are turning and they're generating, you know, 1, 2, 3, 5 megawatts a piece, you are using a lot less fuel under those circumstances. In other words, you're driving 30 instead of 60 for the most part. The big problem is one of stability. You have to have a grid that is something like 99.9% reliable. 0.1% reliability means that you're out of power for about 8 hours a year. And there are many industries that just can't stand that, and they have to have backup power on the source. And the grid is becoming more and more unreliable because people are relying on unreliable sources and pulling the plug on reliable sources. And that is precisely what happened in Texas. But it's happened in many places as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other question on an environment front that I had was, if you're pulling energy out of the wind, surely then you're actually affecting the environment with respect to lowering the wind speed. So, I mean, you don't get actually free power from the wind. You actually decrease the wind speed. Have you heard any examples of where that actually affects the environment?
I haven't heard of examples where it affects the environment. I know of an individual who says that it will affect the weather in the western states because of all of the wind turbines along the Pacific coast. I cannot verify the veracity of his claim. I can just say that he says it.
Well, what about, let's say, Ottawa? If they were to literally cover the city with industrial wind turbines, surely that would reduce some of the cooling that we would get from the wind.
Well, yeah, I think that's probably a good case there. By the way, when you talk about these wind turbines, there's something else that you really ought to think about. And that is, when you imagine something like a 1.5 megawatt wind turbine, and that's getting to be, well, it's huge by California standards of 1970, but it's small by comparison with some of the wind turbines they're talking about now. What I want to do is talk about the leverage. You've got this big push up there on the axle, or on the center part of the wind turbine, push from the wind. And that is equivalent to having a lever the length of a football field and I mean American football field.
Yeah.
And out on the end of that is a loaded school bus.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of twist that you're getting. And the foundations have to be really, really solid. And I have no idea in the world how you're going to put that kind of wind turbines up in Ottawa, in a city.
Yeah, you need huge concrete bases, eh?
You need huge bases. And mm-hmm. when you look at the base, you can just go somewhere and you walk up to them, they look like maybe 15 feet in diameter or something like that. What you don't know is that the diameter is more like 50 feet, and it goes 10 feet into the ground, and it's filled with rebar and concrete. So it's a lot less, or a lot more than meets the eye, we'll just say it that way.
Yeah, of course, concrete itself, you're producing lots of CO2 just making all that concrete.
Yeah. Yeah. Michael Moore, a well-known leftist, produced a movie called Planet for the Humans, in which he really exposed wind and solar by sending a film crew all over the world, actually, to see the how much destruction they were doing in the environment, mining the cement, the metal, the chemicals, and how they were covering it up. It was really quite amazing, and one worth watching if you can see it anymore on the internet. The left probably has taken it off mostly, but the materials required for a wind turbine are amazing, and certainly make them a net negative for the environment. Howard, can you foresee a day when the Congress will end wind and solar subsidies as well as handouts to the companies that manufacture their equipment?
Well, I'd kind of like to hope so. You can write this down and sign your name to it. What they will do is find some other crisis that they have to solve.
Yeah, I've always felt that. Anytime we beat them on one fraud, again, using the title of your book, The Solar Fraud, they will come up with another one, because as you said, they're in business to scare us to make money in some way. It seems like Europe's in much worse shape. They're well ahead of us in using wind and solar power, and their electric rates have skyrocketed, generally at least three times greater than ours. Have you witnessed what's going on in Europe in that regard, and the fact that people are starting to stand up and cry foul about it?
I just got some email today, and I glanced at it, and I didn't take the time to read it carefully, but it was addressing that very problem, that the reliability is lower, but the cost is higher. So they've had a lot of problems over there, and well, if you decide you don't like nukes, you don't like coal, you don't like natural gas, you don't like, well, those are the main sources, what are you left with? It's useful to point out that every source of energy that you can name, and let's start with coal and oil and natural gas and nuclear and wind and hydro and solar, every one of those is regularly opposed by groups that call themselves environmentalists. Every form of delivering energy, meaning by truck, by railroad, by electric wires, by ships, say with carrying liquid natural gas, every one of those is opposed by groups calling themselves environmentalists. Many uses of energy are opposed by people calling themselves environmentalists. They tell you to turn down your thermostat. You don't need the house that cool in the summertime. Don't drive to the grocery store, ride your bike, blah, blah, blah. So there really is a war being fought on many fronts against energy itself. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how I know a solution to it. I'm just saying it exists.
Mm-hmm. But where do you think we're going to go energy-wise in this country in the next century, in this century?
Well, you and I will only see a small fraction of this century, I'm afraid. But anyway, I suspect that eventually people will sober up. One of the nice things is the use of small modular nuclear reactors. And the reason that's nice is because nuclear reactors are typically up in the 1.5 gigawatt, or, 1,500 or so megawatts, or somewhere up in that range. And that is just way, way, way too much power for lots of small towns that are all around, such as where you live and where I live, and so forth. But if you have some reactors that can be made in a factory and they're good for 100 megawatts instead of 1,000 megawatts, or maybe you have 50 megawatts, then you can have an assemblage of these, of several of them, providing power for your community. And you got to shut one down from time to time to change the fuel rods, but the rest of them are still working. And so you don't have the choice of either having full power or not. So I do suspect that the small nuclear reactors will eventually become very, very important.
Mm-hmm. We did a show 2 weeks ago with a nuclear physicist from South Africa that was really outstanding. And he pretty much said exactly as you, the future is with small nuclear reactors. But the most exciting thing he told us was how much lower the cost per kilowatt hour or megawatt is, where we used to build nuclear power plants for the large ones for $3 billion, unnecessary safety duplications because of the fear of radiation have run the cost to a minimum of $9 billion. And he feels that the small reactors can be built for minimal cost and get away from the safety requirements that have been required in recent decades and are actually ultimately, I think, are going to end the completion of two reactors being built in Georgia and I think maybe one in South Carolina. So it's good to hear you reflect that same feeling, and that's really very exciting.
Mm-hmm. I had a quick question for Howard. If you were advising the city of Ottawa and you ignored the fact that carbon dioxide doesn't need to be reduced, but if you did assume it needed to be reduced, surely you'd push the city to small modular reactors instead of wind and solar.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's where they should be going. It's funny because in their master plan, they have a huge master plan because they want to spend almost $60 billion between now and the year 2030. This is for a city, 2050. And this is for a city of only 1 million people. Then they could bring in small nuclear reactors, small modular reactors, and power the city far better that way. Is that so? Would you support that?
Yes, indeed. I'd like to point out to your audience that there was a nice picture in an issue of the Chemical and Engineering News some years ago, about 3 or 4 years ago. I can't remember exactly the date. I could look it up. In any case, it was a picture of a bunch of casks holding the spent nuclear fuel, which contains all of the nuclear waste, from something like 25 years of two different reactors at the Zion Power Station, which I think is in Illinois, if my memory is correct. And there were somewhere around 80, it's kind of hard to count them because it's just a picture, somewhere around 80 of these casks. and they are on a concrete pad that is more or less the size of a baseball infield. And you could walk around those and receive absolutely minimal amount of radiation. And that is the whole load of fuel and waste from 25 years of operating two very large, something like 1200 megawatts each, reactors, which means, you know, between home first, second, and third, and back to home. And there are just a bunch of casks out there that are stainless steel on the outside, and they have all that waste that people talk about as so being so horrible, and it's going to destroy the environment. And you don't need even, I mean, they have it there somewhere, probably a chain link fence to protect people from all that, what people call dangerous radiation. It's just, people don't understand it. They get totally scared.
Mm-hmm. I was reading once that if you were to get all your electricity, and you're an average person in Canada or the United States, from nuclear power, that the amount of high level waste in your entire life to give you that power would be about the size of a golf ball. Is that about right?
That's probably about right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now let's put this in terms of Ottawa. You say you have a population of 1 million. So you would need to have something like 1,300 megawatts of power. That's an estimate. Now, I'll talk about a 1,000-watt nuclear reactor. During the course of 1 year, on the subatomic layer, on some atomic scale, 1 kilogram of mass is converted into energy. That's 2.2 pounds, 1.1 kilogram converted into energy. That 1 kilogram actually has come from 1,000 kilograms, 1 metric ton of uranium. Mm-hmm. That 1 kilogram of uranium has become 1 kilogram of various radioactive waste products called the nuclear waste. And so you have now, therefore, one ton of high-level nuclear waste coming from 1 year's reaction, or 1 year's production of 1 billion watts of power, 24/7. Mm-hmm. And it's
amazing. It's funny, Howard. I've got one more question to ask before we close, but I'm actually writing an article about Einstein's theory of relativity, and even more basically his equation that everyone knows, E equals mc squared, although few people understand it. Why do you square the velocity of light 186,000 miles per second or what have you, such a huge number? But it's that number that tells how incredible amount of energy can be obtained from a very small amount of mass. And in the case of uranium, it's exactly what you described. But I'd like to end with one sort of positive question, maybe a little bit in support of wind or solar. There must be places still that some wind and solar energy could be useful, as it has been for centuries before advances in energy technology. Where might that be?
Well, if I lived off the grid, and there are a number of people who do that in Colorado just for GPs, if I lived off the grid, I would probably have solar panels. I would probably have a wind turbine, and I would have backup batteries, to keep electricity around the clock. It'd just be very expensive, but it is highly necessary under those circumstances. Solar panels are absolutely fabulous for running those warning signs that you see out on the highway where they're doing some kind of construction, but they have to give you instructions by these lights in the middle of the night. They run on solar panels and batteries and things in the space going around the Earth, like the space station and so forth. They run on solar power. They anything we put into space that needs power, it's pretty much solar, unless it's going very, very far from the sun, in which case they use some nuclear. Mm-hmm. Those things, in other words, if you can't get electricity nearby, then it's nice. But the solar and wind as substitutes for reliable power is just plain nuts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So if you were to give an overall message to the city of Ottawa and they want to have clean, resilient city, you would not advocate for wind and solar power taking over from our natural gas and hydroelectric and things like that.
Well, for heaven's sakes, no.
Well, that was fun, Howard, talking about wind and solar and their impracticality and talking about how energy is actually produced. So this is Dr. Jay Lehr and Tom Harris signing out. From the other side of the story, our guest today was Dr. Howard Hayden. So thanks for being on, Howard.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.